Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
Welcome to another episode of Without a Country. I am Corinne Fisher. It is Tuesday. Welcome to the show. All right, let's get it started. Let's keep it going. There's a lot of follow-ups this week to things that we've been working on. Nothing crazy, big news, because we've had so many kind of huge stories, especially ocean-related stories, submersibles, shark attacks, etc. And so there was a kind of a sense of relief looking over the news this week. A lot of bad Supreme Court rulings, everything like that. Not saying the world is under control, but it wasn't like a
hail Satan
kind of a week. And I liked that. That was nice. Maybe everyone took a break, had a barbecue for 4th of July and laid off of being terrible for a second. Call in the gas line if you or a family member lost a finger or an arm in a fireworks accident. That does happen. Do you guys in the booth, do you know anyone who lost any fingers, toes, or parts of their body due to a fireworks accident? That's not really like a New York kind of a thing to know.
I don't know about that. I was at a pretty wild...
Of course, Mike always has to have a story.
No, I was just at an insane 4th of July this year.
Oh, you were? The one that you didn't come to mind for was insane?
It was wild? Okay.
What was going on? I thought it was Alex's friend.
It was wacky. Her friend... invested five figures in fireworks and kept them in a room where the oven was on.
The oven
at one point caught on fire.
Whoa.
And it was like, I mean, we're talking feet away from the entire house going up in flames.
Where were we?
Queens.
I was gonna say what borough, and then
Trump
I was
country.
Like, and then I was like, let me behave myself. I also invested five figures into my party, but it was on food.
Jesus,
that's why I was like,
I'm
really
sad
wanted
I
every-
missed.
Oh wait, not five. Four. I can't. I was like in my head, I was like, no, that's too much. I was like,
two lobster tails a person?
I was like, no, four. Four is still a good amount for food. Yeah, that's why I needed an RSVP, but it was only 20. I could only keep it to 20 people because I had this idea that I wanted to personally cook for everyone. And the most people I think I've ever cooked for is like five or six. And so upping it to 20 was quite the feat. Like my body was in pain because I was standing on my kitchen floor cooking for so long. Like, you know how if you have, I've had jobs like at the spa and stuff where they actually give you a mat if you're standing on a hard floor because you're standing upright, like at a register that like we weren't allowed to sit at the spa because I guess sitting is gauche. I'm not sure why we weren't allowed to sit. We had to stand the entire time, but it was a hard floor. And so me, you know, being the unionizer that I am, I was like, all right, we'll stand. But I was like, we need mats because this is not healthy. So we got the mats. That was my big champion, my big championship at the spa. Always working for the little people, you know? All right. Speaking of little people, we, you know, we did have to let Jorge go because of the immense amount of misogyny that he was bringing to the show. We would have let Mike go because, you know, arguably more misogynistic because he's older, but he is, you know, a girl dad now, which is probably the most intense form of misogyny if you refer to yourself as such. No, being a girl dad, of course, not inherently misogynistic, but self-describing as a girl dad, most misogynistic thing you can do. My dad never once was like, I'm a girl dad. He was like, I'm a dad, you know, and that's normal.
Massive oversight by me to not have it in my Instagram profile already.
That you're a girl dad. Yeah. Well, you don't know yet. You don't know what she's going to decide.
I got a good idea.
That you got a good idea that she's going to decide to be a girl? How do you know that? And also the tone that you said it in was weird.
What do you mean?
You're like, I got a good idea that she's a girl. Like, that was creepy.
Trust me. I know a bro when I see a bro. No, well, I mean.
Thank God now the tables have turned, though, because our new engineer is a woman. Welcome to the show, Tiana.
Hello, everyone.
Do you personally think it's weird when men self-describe as a girl's dad as opposed to just a dad?
Yeah, it's like saying I love women. I have sisters and a mom.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is this. It's like it's this sex equivalent of I have a black friend. It's inappropriate. Exactly. It's fucking inappropriate, and no one asked you. And it only like it makes you. It makes me think like question things that I wasn't questioning before. Just like as a girl dad, it's like, oh, were you? Like, so if you were not the father of a woman, you could be treating women like crap. But since you have one made of your cum, like, you're going to treat them better. Very strange. Very strange. Anyway, so happy to have another woman on the show. I'm excited. I feel good. The air is clear. I did see Jorge walking past the booth wearing a shirt that said on it, "Choose gay." And I said, man, I miss that guy. So we're going to get started right away. 4th of July. Yes, cooking. That's all the things I wanted to describe. I did get a 9-foot bald eagle arch, blow up arch for my yard that I did make my neighbor who is renovating let into the building, and he thought it was my air conditioner. And when I said, no, it's my 9-foot tall American bald eagle, he thought I was joking. And then I sent him a picture of the 9-foot tall American bald eagle. And he said, oh, wow, you weren't joking. And that was fun. We had a good laugh over that. All right. So this week's enemy of the state is, well, enemies of the state are all the men in prison with Larry Nassar who didn't stab Larry Nassar. Okay, that's my enemies of the state this week. I did go with a violent turn on that. You know, I am not someone who loves violence in the prison system. I do very much believe in rehabilitation because otherwise, obviously, what's the point of the prison system? What's the point of going to prison if you're not going to attempt to rehabilitate individuals? I also don't think that it's appropriate for us as mere mortals to be deciding, you know, like about the life and ethics of other people. I think it's weird in general, but Larry Nassar is a monster. There's just really no way around it. And I mean, and you know my thoughts, guys. I think pedophilia is like a mental illness. I think that there's work that can be done. But once you start acting on touching, you know, kids' private parts, then you've gone too far. Having the thought in and of itself, I feel like it's mental illness. Acting on it, that is a crime. So you fucked up, Larry, big time. And I mean, he's already in jail for his sentence is hundreds of years. But the fact that someone stabbed him, that did feel good. It did feel good because you could tell he has the face of someone who maybe if he had been stabbed earlier wouldn't have done these things. You know, some people just need to get roughed up, punched in the face, stabbed a little bit. And so that will be our main story that we'll go into later, because I did feel like I felt out of all the things happening this week, that was the thing that most people were talking about. And we have covered that story at length on this show previously. And, you know, there's very few times when I read something about a person and I'm like, they have absolutely no redeeming qualities. And that is the way that I felt about Larry Nassar. I go, this guy, no redeeming qualities, absolutely nothing Then you start having these I start having these existential questions in my head, like, what was even the point of him existing? You know, I don't know. I do not know. Follow up. While I was cooking for hours for the 4th of July, I did start listening to the Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling podcast, which I have wanted to listen to for quite some time. And a bunch of listeners to both this show and Guys We Fucked had sent it my way because they know it's up my alley, you know, kind of doing the same thing that this show does, really diving into a situation and seeing it from the perspective, you know, I guess I will say of the right and of the left in this sense. It's people who stuck with J.K. Rowling and people who didn't. I also learned that it's pronounced J.K. Rowling, not Rowling. That was the first thing I learned while listening to it. I have no stake in the Harry Potter thing. I wasn't a Harry Potter fan ever. I'm not a Harry Potter fan. I just haven't read the books or watched the movies, quite honestly. So I don't know. I don't have any like nostalgic connection to those. I'm thinking of J.K. Rowling as an author, as an artist, as an individual. And I didn't completely finish the series yet because it's quite long and it's not like a light. Like, you have to listen when you're wide fucking awake. So it was a good thing to listen to while I was cooking because it kept me very much awake. But let me see where I am. I think it looks like there's seven episodes, I think. And I have listened to six episodes. That's crazy. I got through six episodes while cooking, and then I will finish that up. But I do recommend listening to it. And then I was like, okay, well, I listened to it now without any, you know, bias from media. Let me look and see what the reaction was to this. And also, something of note is that this particular podcast is produced by Free Press, thefreepress.com, which is a website that we have talked about on this show that I think is interesting because it's a lot of people like liberals gone rogue or like kind of people who would be described as like maybe centrists, just like free thinker type people who created this website, primarily created by Barry Weiss. And they produced this, which I didn't connect until today. Like, I saw it in the avatar for the podcast, and then I was like, oh, I didn't realize that. So obviously this is the website that does try to turn kind of accepted liberal ideas on their head a little bit. You know, they do have a lot of articles about, you know, have we taken gender dysphoria too far and stuff. So I do want to like reveal that to you before you go into watching it. But it's very interesting. And the person who hosts the podcast, the journalist who's kind of doing the brunt of the work in this piece, is someone who herself was part of, she self-identifies as having escaped a cult. She was a member of the Westboro Baptist Church, you know, who's, you know, terrible. I mean, it is a church, but again, she describes it as a cult, and I certainly would describe it as a cult. People who, like, if you know, a soldier is gay, they'll go and like protest his funeral, like that kind of garbage going on. And so she's had a lot of experience being on wildly different sides of views. Obviously, she left that. She doesn't feel that way anymore. But she was like, you know, if you had talked to me a couple of years ago, I would have had completely different points of view. And if people weren't open to talking to me and explaining why my views were, you know, wrong, I would never have made the change. So it's an interesting piece altogether. And she does, the host does fly to Scotland several times throughout the podcast to interview J.K. Rowling in person, which is not something that's been, you know, being done a lot these days. So you get to hear from her directly, which I thought was like, you know, probably the most interesting part of the podcast. And no matter what you think of J.K. Rowling, I mean, she's an extremely intelligent woman. Like, she's smart. She's a smart lady. Not that you think an author of the books of her length and the level that she's reached weren't going to be good, but she's extremely intelligent and did not come to the conclusions that she came and spoke about publicly and wrote about publicly in a pinch. Like, she researched them, and it talks about her life and maybe why she has the perspectives that she has. Again, I'm not, and it's not just covering her side. It covers both sides. They talk to a lot of prominent trans individuals, people who were fans and are still fans of J.K. Rowling. So it's very interesting altogether. But of course, as soon as I researched it, there was a ton of liberal or just Democratic media being like, this is not factual, you can't trust this, yada yada yada. And so I took a piece from Vulture, which I would describe as liberal media as opposed to Democratic media. Like, Washington Post, New York Times to me is like Democratic media. Vulture is just straight up liberal media, and I do think there's a difference. Hey there, responsible wackos over the age of 21 living in states where Delta 8 is legal. Do you want to get high? Do you want to get really high? Do you want to get really super duper legally high? Well, then now's the time to go over to yodelta.com, where you can stock up on high quality lab tested Delta 8. You know, we love this at Without a Country. We love this product. We love Delta 8. We love yodelta.com because we want everyone in the whole world to be disassociated all the time. And we want to do it with a product that does it the best. And that's Delta 8 from yodelta.com. Okay. My friends love it. They wouldn't keep ordering it if it wasn't helping them properly disassociate. So if you want the vapes or the gummies of your dreams, go over to yodelta.com and stock up on Delta 8. Remember, you got to be over the age of 21 and living in the majority of states where this is legal. Delta 8 is found in hemp and can be legally shipped to various states, and it gets you high. At yodelta.com, you can find a mix of gummies and vapes for all your getting stoned needs. And I can tell you, Delta 8 works, and these products should, of course, be taken responsibly. So once more, that's yodelta.com, the official Delta 8 sponsor of the Gas Digital Network. And if you use promo code GAS, G-A-S, you're going to get 25% off. Once more, that's promo code GAS for 25% off. YoDelta, home of the Delta 8 that will get you super high. Now, back to the news. And so this is by a guy, Nicholas Kwa, sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, who is Vulture's podcast critic specifically. And you can just imagine how tolerable someone who is Vulture's podcast critic is. But we'll see. I've definitely been written about in Vulture, and the joke is sometimes it was nice and sometimes it wasn't. It's not like Vulture has like a singular opinion on me. Vulture doesn't know what the fuck is going on. Vulture writes about whatever's hot. And so this is from February 27th, because of course I'm a little late to the game on listening to this podcast, but I did want to talk about it because it's extremely interesting. So the title is, Can Anyone Trust the Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling? You could not have misunderstood me more profoundly, so says J.K. Rowling in The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling, responding to fans decrying that her public skepticism of transgender identity, for which she's been called transphobic, is destroying her legacy. I will say right off the out of the gates, this first sentence is a little misleading, because it's almost describing it as like that J.K. Rowling doubts that being transgender is a thing. And that is not so. That is not what she's saying, just to clear that up. OK, the 7-part podcast series, which debuted this week with a 2-episode drop, features lengthy interviews with the author, once galactically beloved for the Harry Potter books, now a source of great consternation, promising to elucidate her position on the matter. It marks the first time Rowling has given a substantial sit down since the wholesale upending of her reputation. To brush up, in 2020, Rowling published a Twitter thread expressing her reluctance to share the view that sex isn't the basis of gender, a foundational aspect of transgender identity. If sex isn't real, the lived reality of women globally is erased, she wrote. I know and love trans people, but erasing the concept of sex removes the ability of many to meaningfully discuss their lives. It isn't hate to speak the truth. And again, like, we can interpret this however we want. My interpretation of what J.K. Rowling is saying is not that like being trans isn't a thing. It's rather that being living the life like being a cisgender woman is different than being a trans woman. To me, when I listen to her speak, that is what she is saying. And again, that still might be upsetting to many people, and I'm sure is upsetting to many people. But I think that's just to like to take the bias out of this article. Rolling Leader expanded her position in a sizable blog post, which I read, and I think we read on this show, actually. What followed has been years of furor and turmoil among trans activists and many fans who now see Rowling as aligned on the issue with conservative politicians around the world. And with it, well, which I would not agree to, because many conservative politicians are basically, you know, dead name people and continue to refer to them by the opposite pronoun than they're asking, say that being trans isn't a thing or that it's a mental illness. So none of these things is she doing. And within the United States in particular, who are increasingly targeting the trans community through legislation. Yes, true. We've talked about that on the show, that threatens their access to medical care and public facilities, among other things. Definitely, absolutely making a ton of laws about trans issues, considering the percentage of trans people in America is what it is. Rowling has since been branded a trans exclusionary radical feminist, or TERF. That's what TERF stands for, if you guys didn't know, becoming a prominent symbol for a politics that to many fans cuts against the heart of the inclusive spirit baked into Harry Potter. And that was a big part of it. And obviously, like, something I didn't know as of not having read the books or watched the movies. But that's why a lot of people were especially upset. But which I didn't need to read the books to know that of that Harry Potter, you know, is a series about people who feel like they don't fit in. Because I've been to Harry Potter world and I know Harry Potter fans. You just got the gist that it was targeted towards people who feel like they don't fit in. And I also am someone who feels like they don't fit in, but in a different way. I like it. The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling is hosted by Megan Phelps Roper, who makes for an interesting steward of this project. She rose to public standing a few years ago with her personal story of leaving the Westboro Baptist Church, the Topeka, Kansas-based religious group largely defined by its penchant for picketing an implausibly vast spectrum of things they see as related to the sin of homosexuality. Phelps Roper's path out of extremism was captured in a 2019 Lewis Thoreau documentary, Surviving America's Most Hated Family, and shortly after in her own memoir, Unfollow. Having grown up indoctrinated within the church, Phelps Roper joined Twitter in the late aughts and had her views fundamentally challenged as she began to earnestly engage with the church's critics on the platform. And I love this because, wow, one positive story that came from Twitter, besides me befriending Kathy Griffin, one of whom she would go on to marry. A pillar of her tale is the possibility of coming together and having a change of mind, even of one so virulently militant and previously fixed in a hateful worldview. And so it is this philosophy of hope that Phelps Roper brings to The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling, which, it should be noted, is being released by the Free Press, founded by Barry Weiss. More on that later. Oh, God. The series, that's like such a cunty little aside. More on my thoughts on that lady later. I'm Vulture's podcast reviewer. The series purportedly seeks to engage with the Rowling controversy as comprehensively as possible. On the one hand, by understanding where Rowling is coming from based on the extensive interviews she's granted to the show. And on the other hand, by working to understand where everyone else is coming from through what Phelps Roper has said are interviews she's been conducting with people, quote, on all sides of the conflict over the past year. She lists these various sides in an essay introducing the projects: trans adults, teens, clinicians and advocates, historians, reporters, authors, Christians who boycotted Potter in the 1990s, doctors, lawyers, and even experts on witch trials. And that part is very interesting because I think what we're seeing as we move decade by decade is many people who created, you know, works of art or had views which were boycotted by conservatives at one point in time, you know, end up being people who are then boycotted by liberals in a different time period because they didn't move at the same pace or change their views at the drop of a hat. And it's just so interesting to be like, oh, I'm a person who is creating, and at every different points through history, like, everyone will not like me. And that is so that's so J.K. Rowling, guys. Phelps Roper lays out her intent in that essay. I remain a believer in the power of conversation, she writes. The ones I had for this series challenged my assumptions and showed me that this conflict is even more complex than I had imagined. And I will say, and I understand part of the argument is like that the podcast feels a little skewed. And it's not that when she interviews the trans adults, et cetera, that she is not showing them, you know, grace, understanding, sympathy, you know, any other word or respect. She is offering them all those things, but you definitely can tell she's like a little bit more empathetic towards J.K. Rowling. But I think that's because she, you know, she identifies more with what J.K. Rowling has been through, I suppose. But you do sense that she is like a kind of overly sympathetic, empathetic to J.K. Rowling. I don't pretend to have answers to the deep questions at the heart of this series, but I'm more persuaded than ever that talking and listening will help us find the path forward. A podcast isn't a conversation, however. By virtue of its authorial construction, a podcast or a memoir or a documentary, good to point out, is an argument. And that's why I always laugh when people say, oh, the, you know, Michael Moore's documentaries are so skewed. Yes, because you have to pick a fucking point of view to make a good documentary, guys. If it's just fucking random footage that shows everything, it's going to be the most boring movie of all time. Like, you have to keep in mind, it's still art, it's still entertainment. Okay. We still need to make money. And in the case, it's impossible to separate the argument the show is trying to make from how it's gone about making it. The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling kicks off with a biography of the author in shorthand. It's very interesting, too. What a life. Notably, the first installment places significant emphasis on her experience as a survivor of an abusive relationship with a man, an aspect central to her worldview on transgender identity that she typically frames as being protective of spaces meant for women. The second episode considers Rowling as a target of witch trials, the first time as the author of work targeted by fundamental Christians who had, at various points during her titanic rise to fame, called for bans and in some cases conducted burnings of the Harry Potter book series. In these early innings, the podcast shows a distinct deference to Rowling. A sense of righteousness is not incompatible with doing terrible things, says Rowling in the second episode. What I try to show in the Potter books, and what I strongly believe in myself, we should mistrust ourselves most when we are certain. And again, she's dropping fucking knowledge bombs like this left and right on this podcast. So whether or not you agree with her, there's little tidbits that you can take that I would argue, if you apply them to your own set of beliefs, are extremely valuable. Like, a sense of righteousness is not incompatible with doing terrible things. I mean, that's the fucking motto for this show should be that. It's just knowledge bomb. And that's the problem. And I don't know if J.K. Rowling is just so intelligent that she's kind of making everyone else on the podcast look mediocre, because there are, you know, everyone interviewed is pretty intelligent and well-spoken and learned, but they all seem like dum-dums in comparison to JK. I do have to say that. And it's not, and I'm not saying it's like that I agree with everything she is saying conceptually, but the way that she is saying it, you're like, ah, damn, that was fire. It's normally saying to you, think again. In my worldview, conscience speaks in a very small and inconvenient voice. It's normally saying to you, think again, look more deeply, consider this, right? Her voice lingers, the sound design lending her words weight and gravity. She's neither pushed nor made to reflect on whether she has been living up to her own worldview. I disagree with that. There's a good number of follow-up questions. That Rowling's perspective so utterly dominates the podcast's opening stages is incredibly frustrating. She may well be the main reason most would pick up the podcast in the first place, but that should be all the more incentive to get to the purported multi-perspective heart of the project as quickly as possible. Instead, The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling displays little urgency in engaging with the perspectives of trans people or even complicating the authority of Rowling's narrative at all. This makes no sense, because it starts off, as they mention, very biographically. What are you going to just have an interview about someone commenting on how J.K. Rowling grew up just because they're trans? Like, that doesn't make any fucking sense. Rich territory, given the fact that the author has wielded disproportionate legal pressure against the speech of some critics. We're still is how it's not hard at all to get a whiff of a certain kind of, quote, both sides equivocation. With the recurring motif of witch trials, Phelps Roper constructs a framework that equates the book burning among Christian fundamentalists with the fact that some former fans are angry about Rowling's transgender views, treating them both as illegitimate responses of the same nature. Even if, in later episodes, the show does circle back to meaningfully engaging with the trans community's anger at Rowling, it's already stacked the deck in Rowling's favor. It becomes, but I mean, that makes sense because we're coming into a world where almost everyone agrees that J.K. Rowling is a monster. Therefore, if you're going to come out with a piece, like, it almost has to come in hard from the other side. Like, otherwise, again, no one's going to fucking listen to it, guys. It's still a piece of entertainment. this is not for the consumption of court. Like, what? It becomes apparent then that the witch trials of J.K. Rowling is operating less as an interlocutor than as a translator. What the fuck? Sorry, this person really wants to prove how smart they are with this article, and it's giving me a headache. So we're going to look up this word right now because I've never even seen it in my life. We do this on every episode, Tiana, just so you know.
Interlocutor,
a person who takes part in dialogue or conversation. That's so, wow. You know when someone uses a word, like a word that you never heard of, and it's just so annoying because it's to describe something so simple and then you get so annoyed by the author?
Interlocutor.
That's a good one to know, though. I can use that one. I'm going to be annoying, too. Okay, anyway. Operating less as an interlocutor than as a translator. What it seems to be seeking is not a better understanding of Rowling in relation to her critics, but a clearer sense of Rowling in relation to her own argument. The show is less a character study of a controversial person and more a defense of someone it claims is misunderstood. It's a character study. Whether this is the product of naivete or cynicism on the show's part, it's hard to say. The podcast is produced by a small team that includes Phelps Roper, former Gimlet Media staffer Matthew Bull, and notably Andy Mills. Mills is something of a controversial figure himself. Once a radio wunderkind who came up through Radiolab and later established himself as a key figure in the early days of the modern New York Times audio division, Mills was at the center of a firestorm during the Fabulism controversy around Caliphate, the audio doc he co-headlined with Rukmini Kalamachi, that brouhaha reignited longstanding frustrations within the radio and podcast community over his past workplace behavior, which had reportedly caused discomfort among some female colleagues in particular. He was ultimately canceled in that he was eventually compelled to leave his job at the Times. Mills' fingerprints are all over the witch trials of J.K. Rowling, which is interesting for someone who, you know, when you're doing a piece that is, you know, defending, as they say, someone who really is fighting for safe spaces for women. His voice is the second one you hear after Phelps Roper's at the start of the first episode. It arrives in a field recording that seems to take place at a Harry Potter fan convention where he asks strangers about their relationship to the series and then their feelings about Rowling, occasionally interspersed with brief narrated excerpts from the Harry Potter books. The rest of the two introductory episodes are steeped in a sense of earnestness, somewhat evocative of Mills's Radiolab roots. And then there's the Barry Weiss of it all. Not long after leaving the Times, Mills found a gig helping set up Honestly with Barry Weiss, also distributed by the Free Press. Weiss, of course, is also a controversial figure, a provocateur who built a brand as a flame-throwing Times opinion columnist, targeting, quote, woke concerns before making a public performance out of her resignation. For a podcast positioning itself as intending to seriously explore, quote, all sides of this conflict, including presumably the side that feels repeatedly targeted by Rowling along with figures like Weiss, these are all associations that give the show a tremendous amount of baggage, no matter its intent. Listening with this context, and again, this is something we kind of do on this show off and on, is that when we read a piece, we, you know, briefly research who authored that piece. And even when it is not an opinion piece, rather an article, like obviously in an opinion piece, you really need to look up and see who's writing it and where it's coming from. But even in, pieces that are just news articles, therefore have to abide by the laws of the news and the regulations of the news. I think that still will help let you know, like, why maybe certain pieces of information are being left out, or why some pieces of information that are seemingly not terribly important are being blown out of proportion. Listening with this context, it doesn't take much to wonder. Are they here to truly grapple with the complexity of Rowling's trans-exclusionary politics, or are they merely here to decry so-called cancel culture? And I will say, even me, who has been a survivor, I was going to say victim, but it was funnier to say survivor, a survivor of cancel culture, and you know, a comedian during these times, and certainly someone who has talked about that a lot. Like, even I'm sick of hearing about cancel culture. And I also think, like, you know, I think that it's kind of done the damage to the people that it was going to do the damage to, and then also has started eating itself, you know, so that the people who were canceled, I would argue many of them are bigger than ever. So as we've talked about on the show before, great job, cancelers. Like, you just made, you made the people that you canceled even more famous and even more powerful, because they realized that if they couldn't exist under the umbrellas of, you know, the Netflixes or the HBO, you know, Maxes or whatever it is, they would just then create their own followings and fully monetize on YouTube or whatever, you know, podcasting platforms. And, you know, with the state of technology as it is, there's almost no way to stop people whose ideas you don't believe in, as long as they have their own following. So, you know, you just made them, you made them figure out other ways to monetize and to get their people together. And I would argue that they're stronger than ever. So, oops. The power of conversation. But again, like, this podcast isn't about, they don't talk about cancel culture a ton. They really are talking about the issues, because if it was just like them being like, wah, wah, cancel culture, I wouldn't have wanted to listen to that. I'm over it. The power of conversation may have saved Phelps Roper, but for any transformative discussion to exist, each participant has to view the terms of the interaction as legitimate. And yet the podcast is titled The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling. One side of this is supposed debate is a singular figure of world historical influence with close proximity to capital and political power. Okay. While the other is an emerging demographic whose literal existence is being challenged. Really showing how the author feels in this last paragraph, huh? What are we even talking about here? The podcast says it wants to have a conversation. What it really wants to do is give a sermon. Now, listen, I will totally agree with the author of this article review slash whatever up your assness piece that it is a little skewed in Rowling's favor. But again, as this author says themselves, when you're making a piece like a documentary or a podcast, you do have to choose a side and have an opinion that you are kind of arguing. You are arguing for, and they certainly do, like, don't avoid presenting the opinions of people who feel very differently. Anyway, I think it's certainly worth a listen. But as with everything, you should listen with your own critical ear. And just because something is on a podcast and highly produced certainly doesn't mean it's accurate. So you have to go on and do your own research for yourself. Just like everyone's, you know, just like they say on the C Word with Lena Dunham. It's like, this is what we've put together. But if you're so fucking invested in it, go up and do your own fucking research. You found a fucking free podcast. And I definitely think it's worth listening to and interesting. And while I did find J.K. Rowling to be a fascinating and intelligent woman, I didn't agree with everything she said. I think there was a little bit, and how old is she? There was that tiny bit of a stench of, like, archaicness on her, where she didn't, it seems like, you know, there was still a part of her that didn't that had fears about trans people that I think are not warranted. But there were parts of points that she was bringing up that I think were very valid points to bring up, that, you know, a cisgender female experience is still uniquely a cisgender female experience. And, like, I'm happy to talk about that with anyone. And I think another conversation that was really interesting on that podcast was kind of the how once you call someone a TERF, they are unable to reply. It's similar to how we've seen the word racist used. It's similar how we've heard the word. I mean, Karen is like kind of like a colloquial term racist. But there are just certain words that have been like that are thrown at people, and I think specifically thrown at women, that they can't come back from. Like, if you notice, like, there is something more powerful for some reason about calling like a woman a racist than a man in society. And my guess would just be because there already is such like ingrained hatred towards women that it's like, oh, it's this group that we kind of didn't like to begin with. And now we're going to put like the most evil title in modern society that you can put on them, which is racist. And we're going to add that into it. And so I think that's like kind of some of these words are heavy with that. And like once you call someone a TERF in conversation, and you'll hear, you know, at demonstrations and stuff, you'll see young liberal people do this a lot. They'll just be like, TERF, TERF, TERF. And once someone is yelling TERF in your face, like there's nothing that you can do to reply because no one's listening to you anymore. And so I think when there's like a word that you can kind of thrust upon someone where everyone decides we don't have to listen to anything you say or value anything you say, I think that that's like dangerous. Okay, so there's a big discussion about that specific word and branding, which I think is very, very interesting. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I mean, we've all had a time in our life when we didn't know what was going on and we needed a little bit of guidance. So maybe that time is happening now for you. We're all faced with tough choices. The path forward isn't always clear. And it's nice to have someone who maybe isn't a friend or a relative, has less bias and can just look at things from an outside perspective to help you navigate the journey that is the experience of life, whether it's a decision around your career, relationship, or anything else. Therapy helps you stay connected to what you really want while you navigate life so you can move forward with confidence and excitement and trust your gut, okay? I've benefited from therapy. People have heard me talk about therapy on this show. They've heard me talk about it on other podcasts that I do. And listen, I don't think that you need therapy all the time, nonstop, 24 hours a day. But I think there are certain challenges in life that are certainly more easy to get through if you have someone kind of just emotionally holding your hand along the way. And I think that's really what therapy is. So if you were thinking of starting therapy, I would say give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. And remember, I always say, finding a therapist that you vibe with is like dating. If you are not happy with the first therapist that you find, don't make the assumption that therapy isn't for you. I assure you, you can find someone that you vibe with. I promise you. Let therapy be your map with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/WAC today to get 10% off your first month. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/WAC. Now back to the show. But like, yeah, I want to see how old J.K. Rowling is. Yeah, she's 57. Okay, because I was like, that's one thing I did sense. Like, there was like a bit of almost like scaredness of trans people that I just felt was like unnecessary and over the top. And now that and her being 57 does play into that, I'm sure. Okie dokie. So moving on, let me know. Write me at withoutacountrypodcast@gmail.com if you end up listening to that series. Quick update on Miranda Sings, aka Colleen Ballinger. I mean, this one is just like more fun to follow than anything, just because of the character of Miranda Sings being so fucking ridiculous with lipstick all over her face and being this kind of like inappropriate child who also has child fans but also has adult fans. Anyway, this is from Variety.com. Colleen Ballinger tour dates / podcast canceled amid accusations of inappropriate relationships with underage fans. And again, this is more like the inappropriate relationships are more like things that she is sharing with them online. Some more things have come, have been uncovered. But it's not like she's actually having like sexual relationships in person with fans, but definitely like sending things of a sexual nature via the internet to not of age fans. And it's weird because when you really look at a lot of videos of her character or watch the TV show that she had on Netflix, which I actually thought was quite good considering it's based on like a YouTube character. Part of the Miranda Sings character is that she is an over-sexualized child. Like, that's part of the character. So then you start thinking, like, is Miranda Sings a way for Colleen Ballinger to act out things that are wrong? I hate to use the word wrong, but wrong with her in a artistic way. You know, was she molested and this is her way of acting out? Where did an adult get the idea for an over sexualized child? And then she's obviously having problems like not interacting with her fans as Miranda Sings. Like, there is no clear line anymore between Miranda and Colleen Ballinger. That's kind of what I'm starting to take from this thing. Because, like, Miranda Sings is a wild character. And anyone who's familiar with the character, like, you need to know that. I think there's a lot of stories when parents take their kids to the live Miranda Sings show, they're kind of appalled at the language she uses and the topics that she covered. But Colleen Ballinger doesn't hide who the character of Miranda Sings in. So that's on you as a parent if you're not familiar with that. The fact that she was privately interacting with real child fans, whether she was considering it to be in character or as herself Colleen Ballinger, that's another fucking story. And I can't exactly answer that for you yet. But it's interesting. It's interesting. The 11 remaining dates on Colleen Ballinger's Miranda Sings Live tour have been canceled, and the quote, oversharing podcast she co-hosted with YouTube creator Trisha Paytas, who used to be a porn star, no, right? Am I wrong? I know she's like just an influencer now, but she's
sort of,
right?
She's done like nude modeling.
Yeah.
She's done, she does like OnlyFans stuff, but back in the day, she used to be like the lingerie, like the girls who would pose for the sex toy stuff.
Right. And it, like, is she like, if you go to, I'm sorry, I just, like, a link just came up to Pornhub, so I'm now on Pornhub on whatever, but I'm like, but does she have videos there? None of these look
so
like her.
So from what I understand, she had an OnlyFans, and the part of the Miranda Sings thing was that she shared Trisha's
yes,
OnlyFans.
That's the big revelation that I had this week, which is, that Colleen Ballinger forwarded nude Trisha. It's Paytas, right?
I believe so.
Paytas photos to underage people, which Trisha, of course, was like, that's like disgusting and also illegal. And I mean, yes, that's like, that's crazy. But then also, why is everyone acting like it's normal that someone who has done so much work in the adult field has a podcast with what is arguably a children's YouTube character? Like, it's very confusing across, like, why did Trisha think that was a good idea? You know, because Trisha's one of those people where, like, I like follow her on Instagram and I'm interested in, but I don't exactly know why she's famous. Like, I'm always unclear about, like, why. She herself is a YouTuber too. Like, I get that, but I'm like, she's someone who kind of just entered my world, and I never exactly knew how she got there. I like, she does like fast food reviews and ASMR. That's why I like her.
She's just been a hot mess. I think that's her whole claim to fame.
Right, but people really seem to like her.
Yeah.
Like, my fans, like, really love her, and my fans aren't, like, people who kind of like, you know, like, people who are void of meaning so, really often. So that's why I'm like, maybe I'm always thinking, maybe there's, like, something more to her that I didn't get.
And she's had her own fair share of cancel culture as well.
What has she been canceled for?
I don't have the specifics, mm-hmm. but I know she's gone through like saying weird things online and having to apologize.
She's
constantly.
An odd bird.
Yeah.
Sure. And I mean, that's kind of why I like her, because I'm just like, really, what's going on with you? Like, but she did some weird ASMR that I liked. And then when you type her name into Google, it credit her as an American YouTuber. But then again, sometimes when you type my name, it credits me primarily as an author, and I'm like, that's definitely an inaccurate description, even though I have written half a book. All right. So the cancellations come after Ballinger, the YouTuber and performer who rose to fame with the awkward lipstick smeared Miranda Sings character, has faced accusations that she engaged in inappropriate conduct with young fans several years ago. Ballinger last month responded to the allegations that she formed improper relationships with teenagers, denying that she had, quote, groomed fans who were children. In a June 28th video, she denied the lies and gossip about her partly in song while accompanying herself on a ukulele. The only things I've, this is lyrics from the song. The only thing I've ever groomed is my two Persian cats. I'm not a groomer, just a loser who didn't understand I shouldn't respond to fans. And I'm not a predator. Even a lot of you think so, because 5 years ago I made a fart joke, Ballinger said in the video. As of Monday, the remaining tour dates listed for her 2023 Miranda Sings tour were canceled. Separately, Paytas, a fellow YouTuber and former friend of Ballinger's, announced that their oversharing podcast would end after three episodes. At the end of the day, I don't get embarrassed by many things, Paytas said in the July 8th video. The podcast ending after three episodes is embarrassing. Us doing all this is embarrassing. In an earlier video, Paytas criticized Ballinger for sending nude photos of Paytas from Paytas's OnlyFans account to some Miranda Sings fans. I think it's the most disgusting thing and above all else illegal, Paytas says in the July 3rd video. Representatives for Ballinger did not respond to a request for comment. Meanwhile, a video clip from one of Ballinger's performances in 2009 last week was circulated on social media, and I watched this myself, with some comments alleging she had sung Beyonce's Single Ladies in blackface. And listen, when you watch it, it looks like she has like splotched like dark makeup on her face. But I'm watching it and I'm going, no, like, no one of this level in 2009, like, was on purpose performing in blackface. Like, I just absolutely don't believe it. Like, not no one like Colleen Ballinger. I'm not saying no one, period. And I was like, there has to be something we're missing here. And right. And at the end of this article, it says, however, Ballinger's legal representative said she was, in fact, wearing green face makeup after she performed a song from Wicked immediately prior to the Beyonce number, which was a standard part of her shows at the time. And that's why it appears like in a video phone footage that there's like dark makeup on her face. Again, it's not like a clear circle. It's like splotchy. But I was like, when you watch it, I was like, this just has to be out of context. Like, I just didn't believe it, because I'm like, just no one's this stupid. Like, even if she legit is a racist, just no one's this fucking stupid to do this. And now in this video that Mike is showing, or Tiana, sorry, I don't know who's pulling it up, it is like clearer. But then I say, like, is there no one who maybe watched the run of show and said, maybe we should do this in a different order because this maybe doesn't look good? I don't know. I just feel like people don't really like look at shows and performances and pieces of art for all angles. But the fact of the matter is, when you reach a certain level of fame, you're going to get canceled because someone who no longer likes you is going to take a beef with you. I don't know. That's not exactly how I wanted to word that, but I don't see any way to fight it at this point. When you reach a certain level of fame, we all saw what happened with Matt Rife. Matt Rife was kind of doing his own thing, and then immediately, like, when he breaks all these kind of records with his world tour, every joke is about Matt Rife. Everyone hates Matt Rife. Matt Rife's not good at comedy. Matt Rife's a racist. Like, you know, even tweets of his surfaced this year. It's like, people don't want to see other people succeed, and they will fucking dig something up on you. But the thing is, it's like, we all have something that can be dug up on us. There's no one on the planet who can't, if you really tried, have something dug up about them that's going to make them look bad. I don't believe it. I don't believe that it exists. So we'll just all cancel each other until we die. That being said, like, I mean, obviously don't send nudes to minors. It seems like there's just like Colleen is like mentally ill or something. I don't know what's going on there. I guess we could have picked that out from her character. Again, it's kind of like Marilyn Manson or R. Kelly. It's like, oh, I guess she was telling us who she was the whole time. And that's someone who, because of, I'm guessing that's something that happened to her, like, did not properly develop into an adult. That's really, really what it seems like. And now she's also monetizing her apology song, and people really don't like that, which, again, not a great move, but I think she's probably panicking at this point, like her career is entirely over, so let me just like squeeze all the pennies left out of this Miranda Sings career that I can. And I really like the Miranda Sings character. I'm bummed. I thought it was hilarious. All right. This is a quick little very without a country story that's been circulating online a lot. You probably heard that there was a UK cancer trust that suggested the term bonus hole as a term for vagina. This is from FoxNews.com. It says the more inclusive terms are offered in the Cancer Trust's LGBT glossary. Joe's Cervical Cancer Trust, a United Kingdom-based nonprofit, is offering alternative vocabulary for women's genitalia to increase what the organization is saying is inclusivity in medical language. According to the Cancer Trust's official glossary of LGBTQ, they didn't add the Q here though, inclusive terms, bonus hole is an optional term for vagina in the context of cancer treatment. According to its website, the trust offers the following definition and guidelines. An alternative word for vagina, it is important to check which word someone would prefer to use. The glossary also offers front hole as an alternative term for a vagina. Using the correct language when referring to someone's gender identity is a simple and effective way to demonstrate support and recognition, Joe's Cervical Cancer Trust states in the glossary section of its official website. If incorrect language is used without being corrected, it can cause someone to feel hurt or distressed. This may lead them to leave and to eventually seek support elsewhere. Fox News Digital reached out to Joe's Cervical Cancer Trust for clarification on the term and on what basis the recommendation is made. They said the information is from a webpage written for health professionals to support trans men and or non-binary patients with a cervix to attend cervical screening, Joe's Cervical Cancer Trust told Fox News Digital. The page includes a glossary of terms they may hear from their patients and was developed with expert organizations who work with the LGBT community. The statement continued, our mission at Joe's is to prevent as many cervical cancers as possible. And a big part of that is increasing uptake of cervical screening. Women are our main focus for this. However, some trans men and or non-binary people have cervixes, and to reduce as many cervical cancers as possible, we also provide information for this group. Joe's Cervical Cancer Trust began operation in 2000 after being founded by British businessman James Maxwell. The trust was named after Maxwell's wife, Joe, who died of cervical cancer in 1999. James Maxwell died in 2003. Joe's okay. This is just about the thing. We're good. And so this is a story that had kind of been circulating in a very clickbaity way, basically under like trying to make people believe that they were trying to say that instead of calling women's vaginas vaginas, that they would be attempting to call our vaginas bonus holes to be more inclusive. I mean, obviously it's hilarious, but you know, and I'm glad Fox News, if you actually read the article, is doing correct reporting on this, because I also pulled the article from thepinknews.com, which is like a more left-leaning news source. And basically it was very clear then when you read both of those articles that they're not suggesting to not call the vagina anymore. They're merely suggesting that people who are coming and maybe not identifying as female anymore, but still they want to make them feel comfortable in a cervical cancer screening, that they are using terminology that doesn't make them feel like something they are not. So they're using, you know, suggesting front hole or bonus hole. Again, hilarious to suggest bonus hole. And I don't know who that's like making feel more comfortable, but that's all it was. It was merely a way to encourage more people to get cervical cancer screenings. And I don't think that's a bad thing. So, you know, again, not trying to say that women don't have vaginas, but certainly how the story was framed and circulated. So again, that was just something that can be really easily cleared up by actually reading the article. Okay, I'm going to skip over this next one. The problem with whiteness. Wake me up before you mango. All right, it's mango, guys. You got to get that dick to work. All right, whatever you need to do, you got to do it, because we can't be waiting around here all day. Mango helps men get hard and go hard. Again, nothing wrong. If your dick doesn't get hard, hey, it happens to the best of us. But what is not going to happen to the best of us is not getting dick down if we're in a relationship or if we're having some kind of a sleepover situation. This is a new innovative compound that will level up your bedroom game. It combines three FDA-approved ingredients, and it's a rapid-dissolving tablet that hits the bloodstream quick, so you have fast results, okay? Mango is mango-flavored, as you might have guessed, and they're individually packaged, so you can slip one in your pocket, in your purse, whatever you're carrying around these days. It's 100% online, and you get a free doctor's visit, so you don't have to, nothing embarrassing. You're just going to say, hey, listen, my dick doesn't work, and I want it to work. Can you send this to me? And then the doctor's going to say, yes, I think I can. No subscription is required to try out the Mangoes, okay? Yo, so what's going to happen is you're going to go to mangorx.com and use the promo code GAS15, and the Without a Country listeners are going to receive 15% off your first order. Again, that's promo code GAS15 for 15% off your first order at mangorx.com. And you can give it as a gift, but I will say some people could take it the wrong way. So maybe just leave the website, open in front of your guy. Or order it and put them out in a nice little glass bowl on the sink in your bathroom, which is something I've 100% done before, okay? It's called a subtle nudge. Anyway, mangorx.com, promo code GAS15 for 15% off your first order. Mango, go, 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 dick. Now, back to the news. All right, let's go to the problem with whiteness class. I think this one is interesting. Michael found this one. This is from July 3rd in the New York Times. At the University of Chicago, a debate over free speech and cyberbullying. A student objected to a class called The Problem of Whiteness and tweeted the lecturer's photo and email address. Hate mail poured in. What should the school do? Okay, I will say, well, I guess putting someone's email address is not doxing them, but kind of feels a little doxy if it's not like public, if it's not on the professor's or the lecturer's website. Like, don't do that. It's like, I don't know. I just feel like it's such like a pussy ass bitch response to the thing. Like, I put your phone number and your address up. Like, shut up. Like, go to the house yourself or shut up. Rebecca Journey, a lecturer at the University of Chicago, thought little of calling her new undergraduate seminar The Problem of Whiteness. Though provocatively titled, the anthropology course covered familiar academic territory, how the racial category white has changed over time. And I think right in that first paragraph, we get to the problem. Maybe stop trying to be so provocative in the academic space. She was maybe just try to be academic. She was surprised then when her inbox exploded in November with vitriolic messages from dozens of strangers. One wrote that she was, quote, deeply evil. Another, blow your head clean off. The instigator was Daniel Schmidt, a sophomore and conservative activist with tens of thousands of social media followers. I like that they write tens of thousands, like that's a lot in this day and age. 10K. Oh, okay, cool. He tweeted, anti-white hatred is now mainstream academic inquiry, along with the course description and Dr. Journey's photo and university email address. Spooked, Dr. Journey, a newly minted PhD preparing to hit the academic job market, postponed her class to the spring. Then she filed complaints with the university, accusing Mr. Schmidt of doxing and harassing her. Mr. Schmidt, 19, denied encouraging anyone to harass her, and university officials dismissed her claims. As far as they knew, they said Mr. Schmidt did not personally send her any abusive emails, and under the university's longstanding much-hailed commitment to academic freedom, speech was restricted only when it constitutes a genuine threat or harassment. The university's Declaration of Free Speech Principles, developed in 2014 and known as the Chicago Statement, has become a touchstone and guide for colleges across the country that have struggled to manage campus controversies, particularly when liberal students shout down conservative speakers. Scores of schools have adopted it. But what followed for the rest of the academic year at the University of Chicago has tested whether its principles address a new, rapidly changing environment where a single tweet can rain down vitriol and threats. The Chicago Statement assumes that what takes place on campuses is, quote, in good faith, and that people have an interest in engaging the ideas, said Isaac A. Camola of Faculty First Responders, which monitors conservative attacks on academics. But, he added, The ecosystem that Daniel Schmidt is part of has no interest in having a conversation. What do you mean? What ecosystem? Young men? Jeffrey R. Stone, a law professor, led the faculty committee that drafted the Chicago statement. He said that back then, the group was not thinking about how online threats could harm free expression, never mind this situation where Mr. Schmidt simply posted a tweet with publicly available information. Posting repeatedly while knowing the response might be harassment, said Erwin Chemerinsky, a constitutional law scholar at the University of California, Berkeley. But he said, the hard question is, where is that line crossed? Mr. Schmidt seemed, I also think like, I mean, when you think about when, you know, free speech, I do feel like when you are encouraging other people to harass an individual, like, isn't that, that's like a gray, I feel like that's like a more gray area when like, you're like, that's not technically free speech. That's like, you are trying to encourage harassment. So I feel like that's kind of like a little bit not okay. No matter what your side you're on. Mr. Schmidt seemed to understand that he stood right at the divide. Any other school would have probably expelled me by now, he tweeted in March. UChicago is the only top school that cares about free speech. Classes that explore whiteness have been taught in liberal arts departments for decades. Students explore how white people are treated as the norm, affecting, among other things, wealth and political power, which I think is extremely interesting and necessary. Dr. Journey's syllabus included readings like How Did Jews Become White Folks by Karen Brodkin and The Souls of White Folk, a lesser known essay by W.E.B. Dubois. Similar courses, though, I've come under scrutiny by conservatives for being divisive. Like, what is this saying? That I'm a problem because I'm white, Mr. Schmidt said in a TikTok video. Hilarious sentence. In an interview, I think when it's, am I a problem because I'm white in a TikTok video? The answer is yes. In an interview, Mr. Schmidt said his goal was to show Dr. Journey, quote, what normal Americans think. But he condemned anyone who sent her death threats or hateful messages. What a hero. And he said, even if he had not posted her email address, let's face it, people would have found it. Oh boy. Mr. Schmidt has found himself in adversarial roles before. Over the last year or so, he actively supported Kanye West, the artist now known as Ye for president, work that he promoted with Nick Fuentes, a Holocaust denier. Mr. Schmidt declined to comment on his political activism or his dealings with Mr. Fuentes. In his first year at the university, Mr. Schmidt was fired from the Chicago Maroon, the student newspaper, after his editors said that he had repeatedly antagonized another columnist on Instagram and encouraged others to spam her. Notice again, her. It's like he only picks battles against people that he feel like he can properly harass and intimidate. I hate that. That's like, ugh. Mr. Schmidt said he was simply, quote, calling out a public figure. After he was also fired from a conservative campus publication, Mr. Schmidt turned to his own website, College Dissident, which featured articles like Time to Fight Anti-White Hatred on Campus. Because we know Chicago, big hub of anti-white hate-ness, like not at all. His activism has helped fuel an industry dedicated to accusing universities of liberal orthodoxy. Websites like Campus Reform and the College Fix have for years trained students to report on campus controversies, hoping that conservative news outlets like Fox News, Breitbart, and the Daily Caller will whip out their own stories. All three publications ended up writing about Dr. Journey's class. Well, of course, because again, when you're naming something clickbaity so that students want to enroll in it, you're also opening yourself up to all these conservative outlets who are just chomping at the bit for like little stories like this that they can blow up in, you know, into much bigger issues than they actually are. And of course, and after the course catalog said the class was canceled for the winter, Mr. Schmidt celebrated. This is a huge victory, he tweeted. 2 weeks after Mr. Schmidt's first tweets in November about the course, John W. Boyer, then dean of the college, sent an email to a handful of staff and faculty describing the incident as cyberbullying intended to intimidate the instructor by mobilizing anonymous threats and harassment. The university, he added, would not allow it. But by February, the university had dismissed Dr. Journey's complaints. Officials declined to discuss the case, citing privacy concerns, but said that the school had policies addressing harassment, threats, or other misconduct, including cases that involve online communications, which cover all students. It acknowledged that becoming a target of online criticism could be disturbing. Dr. Journey was furious. "I don't want disciplinary action against this student just for a sense of justice for me personally," she told The Times. "By condoning cyber abuse, there's no deterrent effect." In his dismissal, Jeremy W. Inabinet, an associate dean of students, said he would recommend that the college talk with the student. Yeah, a nice talk. That'll help be helpful. That discussion did not happen, Mr. Schmidt said. In March, 4 days before the course was to begin, he posted again, this time on TikTok, complaining about a December column in The Maroon by Dr. Journey and a local news article in November in which she was quoted as saying, "We can't let cyber terrorists win." In the video, he said, "People have a right to know who's teaching these classes," and reshared her photo and email address. Dr. Journey's inbox was on fire again. And I would argue it's like, okay, yeah, people have the right to know who's teaching the classes that they're in or that their children perhaps are in. But like, also, isn't that part of like what the college experience is? Like learning how to critically think, learning that just because something is taught to you or said to you in a classroom doesn't mean that it's 100% correct. I mean, I've been doing that since, I don't know, the fucking fourth grade. Like if you're just sitting in a classroom, like oh, everything my teacher says is right, as if they're not a flawed individual with their own biases, like then that's on you. That's on you. I mean, I don't know what to tell everyone. Like, if you just think that everything you've heard on podcasts, on the news, in a classroom, from your parents is just right and you don't question it, you're going to end up in a cult. You're going to end up in a cult or in a bad marriage or in a million other things. Like, you can't just believe things. Critical thinking is the singular most important thing that you can teach yourself. Administrators had already amped up security. They had moved Dr. Journey's class to a building that required key card access and did not publicly list the location. I mean, also, if I was going to the University of Chicago, I would probably have not been interested in attending this class until this dipshit made this whole deal about it on TikTok. Then I would have 100% wanted to go to this class. Dr. Journey said the university beefed up security patrols. Again, just making the class way cooler. Officials also took key steps that supporters of academic freedom say many colleges fail to do. They affirmed Dr. Journey's right to teach the class and did not distance the institution from her, which I love. On both whatever this class was, if it was conservative leaning or liberal leaning, I love it. But Dr. Journey continued to receive a stream of emails, hundreds in total, as well as letters to her home and office. Someone signed her up for a Pornhub newsletter. A classic. Dr. Journey filed another complaint to the university in April, this time also signed by Shannon Lee Dowdy, then the chairwoman of the anthropology department. On a campus famously dedicated to academic freedom, they wrote, students cannot be allowed to launch public hate campaigns with the intent of intimidating faculty and shutting down the teaching of material that they do not like, which is completely accurate because so often on college campuses, it's these conservative speakers who are getting, you know, shouted out, which I also disagree with. But if this woman wants to teach this class, she has every right to do so without fearing for her own safety. And the conservatives should know that more than anyone, because it's usually conservatives getting attacked on these college campuses. That complaint too was dismissed. Mary Ann Franks, a University of Miami law professor who studies civil rights and technology, said that universities should pay more attention to the intimidation of faculty members. Yeah. Cyberbullying is much more intentional, vicious, and threatening to a person than someone shouting unpleasant things to a person during a talk, she said, adding that Mr. Schmidt's behavior was very much calculated to generate exactly the reaction that it did. Professor Stone, and also, like, if you're teaching on campus, you have to walk, like, among these people. You're still only one, you know, professor or lecturer in the midst of many students. People probably know where you live. If they don't know exactly where you live, you probably live relatively close to the campus. Like, very unsafe feeling. No one deserves to feel that way. Professor Stone, who wrote the Chicago statement, agreed that the student's actions could have a chilling effect on speech. But he asked who determines the difference between, say, a newspaper reporting on an individual and Mr. Schmidt's actions. Both can result in hate mail and threats, he said. The university, as a private institution, could change its policies to say that. And it's also like clear that like both the left and the right on campus didn't want this guy. Like, this guy is the fucking problem. Like, it's very clear. The university, as a private institution, could change its policies to say that students, staff, and faculty cannot post material that is intended to be intimidating, Professor Stone said. But such a move, which he does not recommend, would run afoul of the First Amendment if the university were public and would bring its own complications, he said. It's very hard for either law or institutions to monitor those sorts of things, he said. Your administrators may be biased in terms of who they go after and who they don't go after. And while a strong case could be made that Mr. Schmidt's intent was to intimidate, Professor Stone said, do you really want to get into the business of trying to figure out what the purpose was? That explanation can be unsatisfying for students wanting a solution. Well, you know what? Students need to learn that many times in life you won't get a satisfying solution. And that is the greatest lesson you can learn in college. Watson Lubin, a senior in Dr. Journey's class, said that he chose the university in part because of its reputation for academic freedom. But over his 4 years, he said he has soured on the free expression rhetoric. I'm worried that Daniel Schmidt actually formed something of a precedent here, he said, where you can, under the auspices of free speech, more or less intimidate and harass a professor and secure incredible following on TikTok and Twitter on them for the purpose of chilling speech. A few weeks ago, as his sophomore year closed, Mr. Schmidt posted another TikTok video about the class and complained again about Dr. Journey's column. This is too far, he said. Kids in my school, what, they're partying, they're having fun. And meanwhile, I got to deal with this. You're such a hero. Can we pull up this guy's fucking TikTok? I need to see this. I only saw stills of it. I didn't watch them. But this guy seems like a real piece of work. It's the blonde guy with the zits all over his face, if we didn't know. All right. Well, he's pulling that up. It's Daniel Schmidt. Do you want me to pull it up myself? I know TikTok is hard to access on the regular internet sometimes. Daniel.
Yeah, this little Trump wannabe.
Yeah, I mean, at best. Logging in. And also, they're acting like he has so many followers. He has 61,000 followers. Like, that, like on TikTok, that's nothing.
Bring it up.
And in his bio, it says future president, University of Chicago. So does that mean he actually won the election?
While marching, they chanted, we're here, we're queer, and we're coming for your children. On that same day in Seattle, naked men rode bicycles at an all-ages parade in front of children. And four kids were just found at a drag queen party next to a dead body that belonged to a transgender person. So all of this happened in 1 week, and it's all that we know.
Okay.
Imagine how much is happening.
Okay, so basically, this guy thinks he's Matt Walsh. This guy thinks he's the next Matt Walsh. It's very clear from his TikTok. These suit choices are fucking terrible. But then he'll also like put a video up that says the Republican Party sucks. But and it starts with like, I'm a Gen Z conservative, but I think that the Republican Party sucks. So, you know, he's just... but he created kind of an online image for himself. It's very clear and clean as like who he is supposed to be. So, I mean, if anything, it should just light a fire on, I guess, other people's asses. But it's like it's one thing to actually like make change in the world. And it's another thing to like kind of just cause trouble and make TikToks about it. And I think that's like where he's kind of missing the message of what he's supposed to do, because it seems like no one's happy with him. So, like, I understand that maybe he has a problem with this course, but then wouldn't you want to, like, take the course and actually constructively, like, criticize it, not just say, I don't like the title of this course, even though I actually know nothing about it, and I'm going to silence this person before I even bother to have a conversation or learn anything that she's trying to say? Like, it's just, it's lame. It's lame. So someone's mic is still on. I can hear you breathing. It feels like a horror movie. All right. Let's see. Wrapping up real quick, I wanted to do a cuties corner because we haven't done one in a while. And sea lions are sick and dying along the southern coast. And I want you guys to know about this. This is from NPR. it looked like some. I was waiting for the drop, but I didn't know if it was coming. Because I know, Mike, you like listening to it.
Welcome to Cuties Corner! Yay!
Haven't heard that one in a while. All right, so it looked like something out of an apocalyptic movie. Over the past few weeks, droves of sick and dying sea animals have been washing up along the coast of Southern California, including beaches in Santa Barbara and Ventura. This is from NPR, by the way. The devastation has been caused by an outbreak of toxic algae on a scale never before seen in the region, according to NOAA Fisheries West Coast Branch. As of last week, local officials had estimated that over 100 dolphins and over 500 sea lions had been killed by the algal bloom. This is so sad. It appears that the toxins are slowly spreading to Northern California. Samuel Dover, who leads Channel Islands Marine and Wildlife Institute, has witnessed 6 algal blooms during his career and described the current one as the worst yet. The bloom is so much larger, he told NPR. This time, it's in the center of the channel where a lot of animals are. Algae are usually benign plants commonly seen in the form of pond scum or kelp, but under certain conditions, they can grow out of control and generate deadly toxins. When that happens, it is known as a bloom. It tends to be a problem for U.S. states near the country's coast and the Great Lakes. Over the years, algal blooms have contaminated tap water, forced beaches to close, discolored coastal waters, and led to the demise of countless animals. Although algal blooms are considered a natural phenomenon, climate change and human activities do play a role in their frequency and intensity. In California, the algae outbreak is believed to have resulted from wind pushing water full of nutrients toward algae, making them grow. That process is not typically related to climate change, but it does not rule it out as a factor either. I love this article because they're like, we really don't have any proof that it's humans' fault, but it probably is. According to scientists at NOAA Fisheries West Coast Branch, that was the information before. I read it in the wrong cadence. Apologies. The bloom in California is producing domoic acid, which generally doesn't affect humans, but is poisonous to animals. When a sea creature suffers from domoic acid poisoning, it affects the animal's brain and causes seizures, erratic behavior, bulging eyes, and foaming at the mouth. Beachgoers have been warned to stay at least 50 feet away from sick animals in case they turn aggressive. Oh, man. There is no antidote or specific remedy for domoic acid poisoning. Veterinarians have been giving some animals anti-seizure medicine and keeping them hydrated in hopes that the toxins will flush out of their bodies. The problem is that the longer the toxins are in an animal's system, the more difficult it becomes to treat the poisoning. Adult pregnancy lions have been the most severely affected by the outbreak, according to Dover of Channel Islands Marine and Wildlife Institute. When Southern California was struck by an algal bloom last year, it lasted about 6 weeks. Dover said. Similarly, the current outbreak in its 8th week appears to be improving and fewer sick animals are appearing on shores. Is there anything sadder than a sick sea lion? This is so sad. To compare, Dover said lately his volunteer group has been receiving about 40 to 50 reports of sick animals per day. A month ago, they were receiving 40 to 50 reports per hour, though many reports tend to be duplicates of the same animal. While that is a good sign, not much can be done to speed up the process. Harmful algal blooms are nearly impossible to clean, especially at the scale that has emerged near California. Oh, my God. Can we just donate money to the sea lions? This is so sad. Oh, these sad pregnant sea lions just on the beach and they look so sick. Oh, poor angels. Okay, well, that was your Cuties Corner, guys. Sorry, that wasn't a happy one. All right, wrapping it up with the main story of the week. This, of course, as I teased at the beginning of the episode, is about our good pal, Larry Slippery Hands Nassar. So the nuts and bolts story I took from the Washington Post, I found it was interesting because both in the headlines from the Washington Post and the New York Times, they used reportedly and allegedly, whereas all the other news sources were just like, yo, he got stabbed. Whereas the Washington Post, again, where we're taking this article from, it says Larry Nassar, convicted of abusing female athletes, reportedly stabbed in prison. And I thought it was interesting that I don't know why the allegedly needs to be used, the reportedly, but here we are. Larry Nassar, the disgraced sports physician who was convicted of sexually abusing female athletes when he worked for USA Gymnastics and at Michigan State University, was stabbed multiple times during an altercation with another incarcerated person at a federal prison in Florida. Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. Two people who spoke with the Associated Press on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to publicly discuss details of the incident said it occurred Sunday at United States Penitentiary Coleman in Florida, with one saying Nasser was stabbed in the back and chest. They added that he was in stable condition Monday and that an investigation is ongoing. I would love that. Like, as if everyone didn't just see it happening and let it happen. It's fucking prison. Nasser admitted to sexually assaulting athletes, including Olympic gold medalists Simone Biles, Michaela Maroney, and Ali Reisman. In 2021, athletes reached a settlement requiring the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, USA Gymnastics, and their insurers to pay them $380 million. In 2018, several athletes testified to more than two decades of abuse, saying their claims had been ignored by coaches, trainers, and other officials. Nasser was sentenced to a minimum of 40 years and a maximum of 175 years in prison for his crimes after 7 days in which more than 160 girls, women, and parents gave wrenching testimony describing the impact of his sexual abuse. "I've just signed your death warrant," Judge Rose Maria Aquilina said in announcing her sentence to Nasser, who is now 59. In a scathing report released in July 2021, the Justice Department's Inspector General found that senior FBI officials failed to properly investigate serious sex abuse allegations against Nasser, allowing his abuse to continue, and determined the officials gave misleading or false answers when confronted about those failures. Yeah, this was all, I mean, again, we've gone over this a while ago, but this was a whole, this was not just him. I mean, he was doing it, but there were so many other people complicit in these acts. One of the agents in question retired in 2018, and another was fired after the Justice Department report was released. Neither has been charged with a crime, despite three investigations by federal prosecutors. Nasser previously had been attacked in prison. According to Nasser's lawyers, he was assaulted within hours of his release into the general population at his first prison stop, USP Tucson in Arizona, in May 2018. Officials transferred Nasser first to a holdover facility in Oklahoma and then to the prison in Florida, which a former inmate has described as a so-called special needs prison, a safe facility where informants, former cops, ex-gang members, check-ins, prisoners who are intentionally put themselves in solitary confinement to be safe, homosexuals and sex offenders can all supposedly walk the yard freely. James Whitey Bulger and other noted mobsters, Leonard Peltier, a Native American activist who was convicted of killing two FBI agents in 1975, and a number of people convicted on terrorism charges have been incarcerated at USP Coleman. Last year, a Federal Bureau of Prisons review deemed the operations at Coleman, the largest correctional complex in the United States, to be deficient, mainly because of its 14% vacancy rate among its correctional officers. Earlier this year, an official with the local correctional officers union said that the prison was short-staffed by nearly 100 people, a number that can reach 175 on certain days. The Florida Department of Corrections logged five homicides at its facilities between July 2022 and June 2023. That's down from the six-year high of 23 between July 2018 and June 2019. The Federal Bureau of Prisons reported about 165 instances of inmates being found guilty of assault in 2022. Former gymnast Rachel Denhollander, the first woman to publicly accuse Nasser of sexual assault, reacted on Twitter to the news of Nasser's stabbing, saying, "None of the women I've spoken with are rejoicing today. We're grieving the destruction across so much. We're grieving the reality that protecting others from him came with the near certainty we would wake up to this someday." All right. I mean, listen, I am usually on the side of like not rejoicing in other people getting fucked up like in prison when they're already paying their penance. But this guy just fucking blows. There's, again, just my opinion, no fucking redeeming qualities for this guy. This guy blows. And then Fox News, you know, God, there is something charming about Fox News, like an abusive boyfriend. You know, you're just like, you know, he's no good for you. But then he brings you flowers and you're like, OK. So they said, why the fuck will we report the news when we can make a listicle? And so Fox News ending out the day, their article on Larry Nasser is Larry Nasser stabbing isn't the first. Five infamous criminals brutalized in prison. Ooh, let's read. And then it's just like they just make it into like something to talk about at the water cooler. I thought it was a very, very strange approach for Fox News, but here we are. Some of history's most notorious criminals have been victims of brutality behind bars and even lost their lives at the hands of other inmates, often because of the unspoken code of, quote, prison justice. The violence typically targets child killers, rapists, and child molesters, like it reportedly did Sunday when Larry Nassar was stabbed by a fellow inmate in a federal Florida penitentiary. The disgraced former sports doctor who was convicted of sexually abusing several female gymnasts, including Olympic medalists, is reportedly in stable condition. However, other criminals, from notorious serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer to a low-level robbery convict who was sawed in half during a prison riot, have not gotten off so lucky. Again, just really, they go, here was one guy who was stabbed, and here's a bunch of other shit. Here are five instances of high-profile criminals who faced violence while imprisoned for their crimes. Number one, Jeffrey Dahmer. Already one of the most notorious, gruesome serial killers, Dahmer became a true crime obsession last year after actor Evan Peters' depiction of the Milwaukee cannibal in a Netflix series. Dahmer killed, dismembered, and at times ate 17 young men between 1978 and 1991 before his conviction and sentence of 15 terms of life imprisonment in the Columbia Correctional Institution in Portage, Wisconsin. Dahmer's notoriety and heinous crime made him unlikely to die of natural causes. The combination of countrywide news coverage that included ghastly details of his crimes and the fact that Dahmer was a gay man who raped men apparently drew the attention of other inmates. On November 28, 1994, fellow inmate Christopher Scarver shoved a newspaper clipping detailing Dahmer's crimes in his face. I asked him if he did those things because I was fiercely disgusted, Scarver said in an interview with the New York Post. He was shocked. Yes, he was. He started looking for the door pretty quick. I blocked him. Then he beat him with a metal bar, bludgeoned him to death, and left Dahmer on the gym floor while he walked back to his cell. A security guard asked Scarver why he was back so early. Scarver reportedly told the prison guard, "God told me to do it. You will hear about it on the 6 o'clock news." If Dahmer, who was 34 at the time, did not die that day, he might have faced other attacks. Before Scarver fatally bludgeoned him, another inmate tried to slash Dahmer's throat in front of prison guards, but he was not seriously hurt. James Whitey Bulger. Notorious mobster James Whitey Bulger led Boston's Winter Hill Gang northwest of Boston before going on the run and evading capture for 16 years. By 1999, he was the FBI's second most wanted fugitive behind Osama bin Laden. In June 2011, he was finally captured in Santa Monica, California. It's hilarious because, like, if you're hiding, like, if you're trying to, like, hide, I would not be in Santa Monica, you know, and ultimately convicted of 31 counts of racketeering and found to have been involved in 11 murders. Despite his criminal activity, Bulger had reportedly been recruited by the FBI in 1975 to serve as an informant. His prison assassination was planned as soon as he arrived in a federal West Virginia prison. As an 89-year-old man in a wheelchair, the Department of Justice said in a report released last December. He was originally housed in the same federal prison as Nassar in Florida before he was transferred to a federal West Virginia penitentiary. His impending transfer was heavily reported by the news and a topic of discussion among prison employees within earshot of other inmates, according to the DOJ report, which said Bulger survived less than 12 hours after he was transferred. It took 7 minutes for inmates to gain entry to Bulger's cell and beat him to death in the early morning of October 30th, 2018. The surveillance further showed that two individuals entered the cell housing Bulger at 6:19 a.m., closed the door behind them, and departed at 6:26 a.m., a report on his death said. His body was not discovered for almost 2 hours. After a prison guard shift change, guards made the rounds and found Bulger's body at 8:21 a.m. with no pulse and visible injuries to his head and face, according to the report. Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler. The Boston Strangler killed 13 women between 1962 and 1964, but it was not until 1965 that the criminal behind the nickname had a real name. During a separate criminal investigation into sexual assaults and burglaries, Albert DeSalvo confessed to being the Boston Strangler, or the Phantom Fiend, as the criminal was being called during the mid-1960s. However, the case remained open and a lack of physical evidence held up potential prosecution against DeSalvo, who was convicted of other crimes and housed in a Bridgewater, Massachusetts prison. While in prison, DeSalvo reportedly planned to recant his confession and, quote, tell the truth, according to letters that were discovered by Boston journalist Casey Sherman. This shed some doubt that led investigators to exhume his body twice in 2001 and again in 2013, after which prosecutors said DNA evidence linked DeSalvo to the rape and murder of Mary Sullivan, 19, who was the Strangler's last victim. In late November 1973, shortly after he wrote the letters, an inmate stabbed DeSalvo to death in his prison cell bed. Donald Harvey, the angel of death. I know about this guy. Donald Harvey was a former nurse who admitted to killing 37 people during the 70s and 80s while working in Cincinnati and London, Kentucky. His lawyer claimed in a book that Harvey confessed to 57 murders. Harvey believed that he was acting as his victim's angel when he killed the terminally ill patients. My one grandmother used to tell me, every hair on your head's counted, and when it's time to fall out, it'll fall out. You're gone, it's over with, Harvey once said, according to Fox 19. While serving his life sentence, an inmate in a Toledo, Ohio prison beat Harvey to death in 2017 in an attempt to give his victim some closure. He reportedly told a Toledo newspaper in a letter. Harvey was 64 at the time. Nicholas Anthony Rodriguez. Nicholas Rodriguez was serving an 8-year prison sentence for robbery in Alameda County, California. His crime was nowhere near the level of the serial killers on this list, but he met arguably the worst fate of all. Sometime during a 2015 prison riot in California State Prison, Solano, Rodriguez's body was sawed in half with his abdominal organs and most of his chest organs removed, according to an autopsy report obtained by the Associated Press. His body was folded and stuffed into a garbage can in a shower stall, according to the report. It took 15 hours to find the 24-year-old man's body. His cellmate, Jesus Perez, who was serving a life sentence for a Los Angeles County murder at the time of Rodriguez's death, pleaded no contest 4 years later for the grisly murder. The motive still is not known. Perez's lawyer argued his client was having delusions at the time. So again, the hilarious things about this is, number one, they just, again, use this Larry Nassar stabbing to make a full-on listicle. And then also, if you notice, this was like by far the longest Fox News article we've ever read on this show. When they're reporting actual, like, current news, they like to do it like it's a children's picture book. And this one, they were like, oh, we have tons of content on other murders. Let's just share this. This is incredible. I found it very interesting. But again, I really don't understand, like, the tie-in, why they felt this was appropriate for what is supposed to be a legitimate conservative news source. Like, can you imagine, like, the New York Times just doing a listicle? Although sometimes I will get emails from, like, the New York Times, not so much the Washington Post, but definitely the New York Times. It's like, 7 songs you got to listen to this summer. And I'm like, what is happening? This is not what I want. Like, I want emails about Supreme Court decisions, not about 7 hot summer beach songs. Anyway, that is our show for today. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, if you wanted to email, I'm very interested in your thoughts. If anyone else has listened to The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling, email me at withoutacountrypodcast@gmail.com. Also, keep sending any domestic violence, death kind of stories, articles that are attached to you personally, that you know someone involved, to withoutacountrypodcast@gmail.com. And, thanks so much to everyone who's been sharing the reels. Those have been have been performing super well. Great way to get the word out about the show. And follow us at Without a Country Podcast on Instagram. And also, of course, subscribe to the YouTube channel for Without a Country Podcast. Thank you so much. I guess we'll keep looking on our own for Shelley Miscavige since the LAPD has closed that. Have a great week. Take care. Bye.